Just about an hour north of San Francisco, California, lies the sleepy town of Woodsboro. It's a beautiful town, the kind you see in movies. It's well-manicured town square, complete with a freshly painted gazebo at its center, is a hub amongst a collection of mom-and-pop stores and diners. Sat out on foot from the square, and you'll see an old-fashioned video store, relics in this day and age, and a convenience store often frequented by the local teenagers heading to parties on a Friday night, and eventually, Woodsboro High. The school is a hulking building, surrounded by lush greenery with a crystal blue fountain at its entrance. And while it's certainly a beautiful building, there's something slightly intimidating about it, which seems fitting for the tale that would take shape around a group of its young students. One that would begin with a double murder of one of the school's most popular couples and come to a horrifying conclusion in a nearby private residence. All told, this famous string of murders claimed the lives of 7 individuals, including those of 2 of the most twisted killers we have ever researched, Billy Loomis and Stuart Mocker. I'm Clementine McDougall.
And I'm Chesterfield Huxley.
And this is Murder Tonic, the Woodsboro Murders. Chet, hello there.
Clem, good to see you.
Here we are for our inaugural episode of Murder Tonic.
Here we are indeed. Remember when we first decided to do this?
Of course I do. We were sitting in that terrible bar in Cambridge.
How dare you call that terrible? That place had the best gin and tonics.
It's 2 ingredients, Chet. There's not a lot of range there. A gin and tonic is a gin and tonic.
That is absolutely not true. The perfect gin and tonic is hard to come by, and that bar had a perfect gin and tonic.
Listen, your obsession with gin and tonics aside, I'm happy to be sitting here with you, with our cocktails, recording our first episode together.
Aww, I love you. Cheers, darling. Okay, so we were in that Cambridge bar, and we got to talking about what else? The true crime movement. And we realize that there are so many cases out there that don't get the coverage that they should through podcasts or streaming docudramas.
It's so true. So we decided, who better than to bring those stories to the forefront of our consciousness than 2 Harvard dropouts with an affinity for binge drinking and murder.
And after several months on the road in a rented RV.
Which I think I want to buy and turn into my full-time house, by the way.
Here we are, introducing our baby to the world.
And we're getting started with a bang, too, in this case. The Woodsboro murders.
We certainly are. These Northern California slayings shook the country when they happened. And while there have been retellings and reimaginings since, some were better than others and never quite captured the full picture of what happened.
That's right. So our goal was to get the full story. Experience the town for ourselves, talk to the people that were there, and report back truthfully and with respect to those who lost their lives.
So without further ado, grab your gin and tonic and settle in. This is the Woodsboro Murders. We now know that this killing spree at the hands of Billy Loomis and Stu Mocker technically began a year prior with the death of Maureen Prescott and the framing of Cotton Weary, but the climactic 3 days that ended with the Mocker House slayings really began with Casey Becker and Steve Orth. So let's start there.
Yes, at first, these murders, starting with Casey and Steve, were thought to be the work of a new killer, as the connection to Maureen Prescott was not initially known. Had Billy not revealed himself to Sydney at the Mocker House, I'm not sure the truth ever would have come out. But I agree, starting with Casey and Steve seems like the right way to begin.
On a warm Wednesday night in mid-September, 17-year-old Casey Becker was home alone, prepping for the arrival of her boyfriend, 18-year-old Stephen Orth. Casey's parents were out for the night, and she and Steve planned to spend the evening in the family's living room, watching movies and eating popcorn.
The Becker house was a sprawling modern abode, painted bright white and encased almost entirely in floor-to-ceiling windows. A variety of potted greens and flowers lined the wraparound porch, a source of pride for Mrs. Becker, who often spent her weekends gardening and tending to the Beckers' expansive property. An old-fashioned tree swing, fashioned out of a rope and plain wooden board, hung from the large willow tree in the front yard. When Mr. Becker spoke to local news outlets, he recalled putting that swing up when Casey was just a little girl. He told them he had never quite had the heart to take it down, despite Casey's interest in using it waning as she grew into a teenager. The fact that this swing would be used in such a gruesome way on the last day of Casey's life is so tragic, but we'll get to that later.
Casey Becker, with her short blonde bob and ivory skin, was among Woodsboro High's elite popular crowd. According to her teachers, she excelled in nearly all of her subjects in school, especially English, where, coincidentally, she sat beside Sidney Prescott, who we'll discuss at length later on in the episode. When we spoke to Christy, a student at Woodsboro High during the time of the murders, she said that Casey was universally liked among her peers. She had her group of friends she ran with, said Christy, but no matter who you were, she would smile or wave at you when she passed you in the hallway. She was that kind of person.
Her boyfriend of about a year, Steve Orth, fit the mold of the classic prom king. He was handsome, with tousled dark hair and a broad, strong frame. Rarely was he seen without his gold and blue Letterman jacket, earned for his role as quarterback of the high school football team. Christy told us that it was likely Steve and Casey would have been named homecoming king and queen later on that month. Would they have been alive long enough to attend the dance?
I was homecoming king my senior year of high school.
You were not.
I was. Why is that so hard to believe?
I'm sorry, I don't mean to judge. I just wouldn't peg you as the type. Were you a popular kid in school?
Not at all, actually. There was a tradition in my school that someone would pull an epic prank on the first day. Normally, I had no interest in things like that, but my group of friends and I wanted to prove the theory that the person who pulled the wildest prank was all but guaranteed to be crowned king that homecoming, no matter what their social status. So, we orchestrated the prank to end all pranks, pulled it off, and 4 weeks later, I was homecoming king.
That's wild. What was the prank?
Well, I'm not sure I should say it on air, but let's just say it involved a raccoon, our principal, Mr. Laham, and a giant tub of mayonnaise.
That's disgusting, and exactly enough information for me to determine that I don't want to hear another word about that.
Back to Casey and Steve.
Yes, please.
The police report from the crime scene at the Becker's house paint a pretty horrific picture of what may have happened to Casey and Steve. Investigators found the Beckers' living room TV screen casting a ghostly blue light throughout the dark living room, a VHS tape popping out of the VCR player below. Looking at the tape, you could tell that the movie hadn't been started, so it was determined that Steve never fully made it to Casey's. That is, he arrived and was more than likely snatched by Billy and Stu prior to ringing the bell and seeing Casey.
Now, was it determined in this case, and for the rest of the murders, actually, if Billy and Stu always acted in tandem, or were there times where one took the lead or committed the crime on his own?
Well, we'll never actually know for sure, but there are a lot of theories out there on who actually committed which crime based on several factors, including the location of the guys at any given time, down to the way they each handled the knife when attacking someone. But a lot of the physical maneuvers they managed to execute, specifically where the bodies of Casey, Himbry, and Kenny were found, which we'll get into later, suggests that they often worked together.
Back at the Becker house, the floor lamp next to the TV had been unplugged, most likely by Casey in an attempt to hide her whereabouts within the house. The glass patio door beside the TV was shattered, a patio chair flung through it from the outside.
The house had several doors on the first level. The main front door, a side patio door made up mostly of glass, as well as the back patio door, also primarily glass. The puzzling thing to investigators at the time showed that all of those doors were locked from the inside. So either Billy or Stu came in through the broken back patio door, which is certainly possible, or they had access to a key.
Well, Stu and Casey dated briefly before Casey was with Steve. Is it possible that Stu knew where the spare key was hidden?
Absolutely. It's also possible that Stu could have used that key to get into the house, then hid somewhere within the house, like a hall closet, until he and Billy were ready to make their move.
According to reports from Sidney Prescott, one of the killers, presumably Stu, was hiding in her hall closet when she was attacked the following night. So it certainly checks out as a plausible theory.
Now, one of the most interesting pieces of evidence in these cases was the phone logs for the Beckers' landline. Vital Phone Company showed 6 calls to the house within a 13-minute span, the final call lasting the longest at just over 10 minutes. In the statement given by Sidney Prescott that we previously mentioned, she said that the killer, either Stu or Billy, called her on the phone prior to attacking her. They chatted with her in a friendly manner at first, but the tone of the call turned violent very quickly, and it wasn't until she hung up that the physical attack began. Further investigation revealed all of the calls to Casey came from Neil Prescott's phone, Sidney's father, but it was later proven that Billy and Stu cloned his telephone number to lead the police in the wrong direction. But the fact that there were 5 answered calls in 3 minutes to Casey prior to the final 10-minute call that would still be live at the time of her death is very interesting to me.
Right. And we really have no way of knowing what was said on those calls. Did Casey know right away that this was a dangerous situation and try to disconnect immediately, but they just kept calling back? I mean, what else could explain 5 calls in 3 minutes?
Well, we know how manipulative and cunning Billy and Stu could be. After all, they made it a full year after killing Maureen without their friends or girlfriends suspecting a thing, so it's hard to say.
For sure. Investigators, upon arriving at the scene, also noted that they could still smell smoke wafting through the house from the kitchen. Casey, more than likely before or during that very first phone call, had been popping popcorn on the gas stove, and as things escalated, the popcorn was abandoned, leading to flames engulfing the aluminum foil basket and the kitchen filling with smoke. Mrs. Becker reportedly extinguished it in the sink upon arriving at the house.
After assessing the initial appearance of the scene, investigators moved on to the bodies. Steve was discovered duct-taped to an outdoor chair on the back patio, his head bent back against his shoulders. A knife was used to slice him horizontally across his midsection, and the deep, intense nature of the cut more than likely led to a quick death. Sheriff Burke said that the state of Orth's body and the crime scene itself was one of the most horrific scenes he had ever encountered in his tenure on the force.
Casey's body was discovered by her parents hanging from a tree in the front yard, her abdomen sliced open as Steve's was. But her cause of death was determined to be from the 3 stab wounds she received to the chest. In terms of physical evidence, a knife, taken from the knife block in the Becker's kitchen, was found amongst broken glass on the side of the house. Police surmised that Casey must have grabbed it for protection and somehow lost possession of it during the struggle, as the knife did not match the stab wounds on Casey's body. The Becker's cordless phone was also found underneath Casey's body, covered in blood and lying in the grass. Mrs. Becker reported to the police that, while she and her husband arrived home and realized that something was wrong, prior to them discovering the body of their daughter, she picked up the phone on the hall table to call the police. But instead of a dial tone, she heard grunting and moaning, more than likely coming from Casey. What a horrible thing for a parent to experience.
I know. Not only losing your child in such a horrific way, but to have to hear the last painful moments of their death. We attempted to speak to the Beckers, but were unfortunately turned away. But we didn't manage to speak to Evelyn McKenzie, the Beckers' closest neighbor. She told us that Mrs. Becker burst into her house in hysterics on the night of the murders. She was as white as a sheet, McKenzie recalled, as we sat with her in her living room over tea and cookies. She was so hysterical I could barely make out what she was saying, but eventually she managed to say that something had happened to Casey, and she needed to use our phone. That poor family. So much tragedy.
Well, so much more information would come to light on the murders of Casey and Steve in just a few short days. And there are a lot more players in this story we have yet to talk about. But before we get into that, let's take a quick break. Cocktail refill.
Oh, you know it.
Okay, we'll be back after the break. We have so much more to talk about.
We really do. Hang on. Let me grab my drink.
Very important to the recording of this podcast, Chet's Gin and Tonic.
As essential as our notes and audio gear, my dear.
I know.
So, okay. There are a couple of people in the mix of this story, and it's important that everyone knows who they are and how they fit into the overall picture and what their role was in the case.
Well, one of the major, most well-known people that was wrapped up in this case was Gail Weathers, a local TV personality.
Absolutely. And Clem, you have some personal connections to Gail Weathers. Is that right?
Well, I don't know her, but yeah. Gail definitely played a role in my childhood. So I grew up in San Francisco, which puts Woodsboro like a stone's throw away from my childhood home. My dad...
Oh my God, I love your dad. Shout out to Oscar.
You're like one of my dad's best friends.
He's the best. He would come to visit you at school and take us out to get ice cream every single time, even if it was 15 degrees outside. He always had his newsboy cap on and his little cardigan sweaters. He's the best.
He really is. Hi, Dad, if you're listening. Anyway, my dad loved Top Story, Gail's nightly news show. So growing up, it wasn't a weekday evening in the McDougal house without Gail's voice coming through our TV set. So when this story started unfolding and Gail's career started to take off, my dad was right there following along, hanging on Gail's every word.
Well, Oscar wasn't the only one invested in Top Story and Gail's reports. She was really the first to cover this story as it happened. She had connections with all the local officials, including Deputy Dwight Riley, or Dewey, as he was known around the community, and used those connections to get ahead and pretty much always be the first on scene when something happened.
Yeah, and, you know, I really appreciate a woman's hustle in the professional world, and I recognize that she had to fight her way to get to the top, but Gail pulled some shady shit during this investigation.
Oh, absolutely. So first, I think it's important to mention that Gail was the reporter who covered the murder case of Maureen Prescott, and specifically, worked to get the story of Cotton Weary, the accused murderer, out into the world.
Yes, definitely. So, a year prior to the Woodsboro murders, a woman named Maureen Prescott was found raped and murdered. Sydney Prescott, Maureen's daughter, who was 16 at the time, testified against Cotton at the trial. She claimed that she saw Cotton leaving the Prescott house wearing a jacket covered in blood. Police later traced that jacket to Cotton's car, and this jacket became the key piece of evidence in the case.
And Sydney was the key witness in the trial as well. Her testimony was what ultimately led to the guilty verdict handed down by the jury. And throughout all of this, it was pretty clear that Gail thought Sydney was lying, or at the very least, confused and misinformed. And this divide over Cotton's innocence or guilt created a huge chasm between Gail and Sydney that the public would see play out throughout the murders that took place a year later.
And of course, we know now that Cotton was in fact innocent, as Billy Loomis and Stu Mocker confessed to the murder directly to Sydney during the Mocker House massacre.
Right. We'll talk a lot more about the motives of Billy and Stu, but the primary motivator, at least for Billy, was that Billy's father, Hank Loomis, was having an affair with Maureen. Hank's wife found out about the affair and ultimately decided to leave the relationship, also leaving her son and her role as a mother. And this super secret information stayed within the family. We found no indication that anyone knew about this prior to Billy revealing it to Sydney.
There's a lot of complicated history between these families here, so while there are probably still some things we'll never know in terms of Billy and Stu and why they did what they did, this has to be a huge motivating factor.
For sure. And, unfortunately, there was talk, even before the Hank-Maureen connection came to light, that Maureen had a reputation for partaking in extramarital affairs with several men who lived in the town. And this ultimately led to Sydney, her daughter, having a rough go of it at school.
Okay. Can I just say something?
Yes.
Okay. So I don't want to speak ill of the dead.
Of course not.
But Maureen, what are you doing, girl? If you're unhappy in your marriage, leave. Don't carry on with multiple men and create all of this grief and drama for your poor husband and daughter to carry around. Not only that, but your bed hopping essentially breaks up a family, creates a murderer, and leads to the kidnapping of your husband and the terrorizing of your daughter.
Absolutely, I agree. Look at your life, look at your choices, am I right?
That's all I'm saying.
Agreed, okay. So, we know that Gail and Sydney have a history prior to Casey and Steve's death. We know that Sydney dealt with a lot of tragedy, and we know, though Sydney was unaware at the time, that her boyfriend Billy and her friend Stu were ultimately to blame for what happened to her mother. It's also important to note that Sydney and Billy had been together for about a year when Billy killed Maureen.
And Tatum Riley, Sydney's best friend, was romantically involved with Stu.
So, we have two best friends dating two guys who are actually murderers. You know, I know we see this so often when we examine the lives of serial killers and the people who make up their social circles, but it still throws me every time I hear that the significant other of a serial killer had absolutely no idea their partner could be capable of something like that. I guess you never really know until you're living it. But don't you think you would know?
Yes, or at least sense something was off at some point. I mean, Sydney and Billy were together for a year after he killed Maureen. And, like, I know we want to be sensitive to everyone involved.
But come on, ladies, open your eyes.
Right? I mean, we talked to multiple sources who said Billy, even though he's pretty damn hot, was a creepy dude. He's a little greasy, always sort of quietly skulking around town. I mean, read the signs, girls.
Like you read the signs with that guy, what's his name? Donut guy?
How dare you bring him up?
He could have painted non-committal on his chest, and you still would have chased after him.
Listen, I can't control who my heart and my loins fall for, okay? And you're lucky that I don't start bringing up your dating history here. This episode would be 11 hours long. Remember the guy who took you to his uncle's funeral on your first date? Or that guy who could only have sex with whale sounds playing in the background?
Okay. Yes, point taken. Can we talk about Sydney now?
Yes. So, Sydney.
Okay, Sydney. So, Sydney goes to school the day after Casey and Steve are killed and learns of the murders from her best friend Tatum. The police show up at school to question the students throughout the day, and Sydney is pulled from English class to meet with them, along with Arthur Himbry, the school principal.
Speaking of Himbry, we spoke to several individuals, students and adults, who said that something about Arthur Himbry seemed off.
Yeah, and it never amounted to any formal inquiry into him or his whereabouts that previous night, and ultimately Himbry would become another victim of Billy and Stu, silencing those suspicions for good. But yes, that was a theme that was mentioned quite often in our interviews.
Even Sheriff Burke alluded to this when we spoke to him. Burke mentioned that during these questionings, Himbry showed some questionable behavior towards some of the students. Apparently, while talking to Sydney, he reached out and cupped her chin, which did not sit well with Burke.
Well, obviously not, because that's creepy as hell. Who does that? I don't even cup your chin, and we've known each other for 10 years.
Do you want to cup my chin? See how it feels?
I kind of do.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay. All right.
Oh, you're doing it.
Nope, it's weird. Nope.
We've very scientifically proven that this is a weird gesture, even among friends. So, it makes sense that Burke would have clocked that when Himbry did it to Sydney.
Absolutely. But, like we said, even though Himbry gave off some weird vibes, ultimately he was innocent, and sadly the next victim in this string of murders. His body was found gutted and hanging from the football goalpost at the high school late Friday night.
The night following the police's visit to the school, Sydney was home alone, awaiting a phone call from Tatum, who would be picking her up after practice. Sydney was to spend the night at Tatum's since her dad was out of town, and with the murders going on, I imagine she didn't want to be alone in her house.
Yes. It's important to mention that Sydney's dad, Neil, had left town on a business trip the morning after Casey and Steve were killed. Now, we mentioned Neil before, and that the calls made to Casey before she was killed were traced to his cell phone, which had been cloned by Billy and Stu. But for a short time before it was realized Billy and Stu cloned his phone, Neil was a solid suspect in the eyes of the police, especially when it was discovered that Neil was not, in fact, registered at the hotel he told Sydney he would be staying at while at his conference.
Right. The phone calls, plus his unknown whereabouts, certainly look suspicious and like a solid lead for investigators. And on that Friday night, the night of the mocker party before Billy and Stu revealed themselves, Neil's car was found in the woods by Dewey and Gale. Lots of strikes against Neil for sure.
So, Sydney's waiting for Tatum to pick her up, and then she gets a phone call. We mentioned this call earlier, but Sydney's statement to the police was that the caller was friendly at first. She even mistook the caller for Randy Meeks, a friend of hers. But then the call turned ugly very quickly, leading to Sydney hanging up the phone and subsequently being physically attacked in her home shortly after 7 p.m.
A costume mask was found at the scene, which would eventually be dubbed the Ghost Face Mask. And this was the first indication of what this killer, or killers, actually looked like as they committed their crimes.
Authorities looked into this costume but found it was untraceable, as it was sold throughout the state in a variety of five and dime stores.
Right, so that was a dead end. Especially since, after word got out about the costume, local teens bought out the stock at all of the neighborhood stores and ran rampant throughout the school and town wearing it. Teenagers are assholes, man. Like, if these kids didn't flood the town with Ghostface costumes, maybe more people could have been saved, you know?
Yeah. There's no better way, if you're Billy or Stu, to hide in plain sight than to have the same costume as dozens of other people running amok in the hallways at school.
And speaking of Billy, he shows up at Sydney's house as she's fighting for her life. And while at first she's relieved to see him, her feelings change, according to her report, when a cell phone fell out of his pocket as he was embracing her, leading her to believe that maybe he was the one speaking to her on the phone and ultimately the one to attack her.
The police arrive, with Dewey the first one on the scene, and they actually haul Billy in for questioning. He spends the night in jail, then is released the next morning due to lack of clear evidence and the fact that the calls to Sydney and Casey did not come from the phone number associated with the phone that was in his possession.
So, with a murderer on the loose and no clear suspect or course of action, the town calls an emergency curfew, effectively closing schools and businesses early. And when that happens, and you're a teenager who is terrified of being murdered and now has an entire night free, what do? You throw and attend a party.
Of course. Stu decides to hold a party at his house that night. And this party is to be the scene of several more murders and the bloody conclusion to this horrifying chapter in the town of Woodsboro. We'll get into this party in great detail, but first, let's take a break.
We're back. Our gin and tonics have been topped off, and we're ready to break down the conclusion of the Woodsboro murders, which occurred, as we mentioned, at the Mocker household, which we were lucky enough to visit on our RV road trip.
Oh my God, yes, we did. So, the drive to the Mocker house is a long one. You have to follow several windy roads through the rolling hills of outer Woodsboro. And at times, it feels like you'll never reach the house. But when you finally do, your breath catches at the beauty of it. It's a huge western-facing Gothic farmhouse with gorgeous views of the rest of the town just beyond. There's a front porch with quaint spindles and a deep green front door, a volleyball net in the adjacent side yard, a three-car garage tucked off to the side, a point that will come into play later in the evening, and front and center, a Victorian stained glass window that looks like it came straight out of an old church. The whole house is surrounded by a picket fence, a utopian image enclosing the site of a sinister bloodbath.
Unfortunately, we were escorted off the property before we were able to see the inside of the house, but based on the images taken the night of the murders, the interior is just as impressive. A grand entryway with a towering staircase, more stained glass, and multiple entry doors to nearly every single room. Nearly 30 teens gathered in the house that Friday night, thumbing their nose at the local authorities and the citywide curfew that was imposed earlier that day.
Speaking of local authorities, can I just say something about Dewey for a second?
Absolutely.
Okay, so something that's always bothered me about this party was the fact that Dewey, an active duty police officer, was just chilling at this party with Gail as 30 plus teens got shit-faced.
Right? I mean, sure, tensions were high, and Dewey probably figured if he was there supervising the whole thing, how bad could things get?
Well, pretty fucking bad by the end of the night, body count.
And he kept his job after this. I mean, how was he not immediately let go?
That's what I'm saying. And like, it's pretty clear that the town and the rest of the Woodsboro police force doesn't respect him at all. I mean, they call him Dewey, for Christ's sake, despite his constant requests to be called Deputy Riley while he's on duty. The whole thing is just wild. And as I mentioned, Gail was at the party with him. This was like their twisted first date or something.
Well, they didn't come together.
No, Dewey drove Tatum and Sydney, and Gail came in a news van with Kenny, her cameraman, but they met up outside the party and came in together. If you ask me, she was using him to get into the party.
Well, yeah, but then they fell in love.
Oh my God, Clem, you're such a sap.
I know, I can't help it. I just want to believe in them as a couple, so sue me. But that being said, it's pretty clear that she used him, at least in that moment, to get in and plant her camera.
Right. This footage ended up being really helpful in the police's case, as it provided a clear timeline as to the end of the party, as well as the comings and goings of our major players, Sydney, Billy, Stu, and Tatum, among others.
Speaking of, let's talk about Tatum.
Yes. Tatum Riley. Sydney's best friend, mm-hmm. Stu's girlfriend, mm-hmm. and Dewey's sister. Mm-hmm. Sydney reported that she lost track of Tatum amongst the party guests within an hour or two of their arrival, and nobody else could recall the last time they saw her, nor did they remember her entering the garage, so unfortunately the circumstances surrounding her death are unclear. Her body was found suspended within the garage door, her torso stuck in the pet door, and her head crushed in. She had a long cut on her left forearm, which seemed to occur during the struggle that ultimately resulted in her death. Police found several broken beer bottles inside the garage.
Okay, one, I don't understand how nobody could remember seeing her enter the garage. Two, I also don't get how nobody saw her hanging from the garage door as they were leaving the party.
Well, the garage was on the side of the house, not really visible from the front where most of the partygoers were parked. The family's boat was also parked in the driveway directly in front of where Tatum's body was, possibly obstructing the view of anyone passing by. Plus, let's be honest, I can't imagine anyone left that party in a sober state. A bunch of self-obsessed drunk teens at 2 a.m. can't expect too much out of that situation.
You're totally right.
I want to talk about the doggy door.
Please.
Is it really realistic to think that a human being can fit through a doggy door?
Well, if I was being chased and that was my only way out, I'd give it a shot.
Sure, but why not just hit the button and open the garage door? There were three of them after all, plenty to choose from. You know, we don't like to speak ill of the dead.
Of course not.
But it seems like Tatum made a lot of stupid choices that ultimately led to her untimely death.
Chet, my friend, you're not wrong.
So, at some point during the night, Dewey and Gail go for a walk. And on this walk, roughly half a mile down the road from the Mocker house, they discover an abandoned car registered to Neil Prescott, Sydney's father. This kicks off the finale, so to speak, of this night and sets the wheels in motion towards the truth.
Yeah, things start to happen really fast after this. Dewey and Gail head back to the party, but end up separated.
Gail heads to her van to get her phone to call 911, but is attacked by Stu or Billy. She manages to evade them, hops into the van to get the hell out of Dodge, but she instead discovers the body of Kenny, her cameraman. His throat was slit and his body was hoisted atop the KQIS news van. You gotta give these guys credit for going all out. I mean, why not just randomly kill the dude and leave him in the bushes? Heck no, let's hoist this fat, heavy carcass to the top of the van to ensure he's discovered in the most gruesome way possible. Gail freaks the fuck out, puts the pedal to the metal, Kenny's body goes flying, and Gail loses control of the van, crashing into a tree.
While all of this is going down, Sydney and Billy are upstairs in Stu's parents' bedroom. Once they're finished taking care of business...
Wait. Can I just say something?
You know I love when you just say something, darling.
Sydney, honey, bodies are piling up all around you. 24 hours ago, you sent this man to jail, and now you're banging him in your friend's parents' bed? What in the fresh hell are you thinking?
Listen, I'm just gonna say it. Billy's hot. I get it.
Jesus, Clem, you and your serial killer crushes.
What does that mean?
I vividly remember you saying that Ted Bundy was hot as fuck and that young Ted Kaczynski could ride you into battle.
I've said it before. I will say it again. The actions of my loins is not something I can control. Now stop getting us off track.
Okay, yes, let's get serious here. We're at the big finish. So Sydney and Billy are... upstairs. Then, according to Sydney, Billy was attacked by Ghostface. Blood everywhere. She bolts from the bedroom, down the stairs, and spends the next, say, 20 minutes fleeing from the killer. She runs through the house, into the attic, out the window, across the yard, in a car for a bit, where she sees that Dewey has been stabbed inside the house, and finally, back to the house, where she encounters Stu and Randy, the fifth member of their friend group.
We haven't actually touched on Randy yet, but yes, he was a good friend of Sydney's who worked at the local video store. He was at the party that night, pretty much all night, and was a witness to the final act when Billy and Stu revealed themselves to Sydney.
So Sydney runs past Stu and Randy into the house, shutting and locking the front door. At that point, Billy comes tumbling down the stairs. Sydney helps him up. Billy takes possession of a gun that Sydney had acquired at some point while running, opens the door, and lets Randy in the house. Before anyone realizes what's happening, Billy, apparently unhurt, straightens up, aims the gun, and shoots Randy in the shoulder, officially revealing himself as the killer. One of the killers.
Right, because Sydney turns to run and slams right into Stu, who has a voice modulator in his hand.
Oh my God, the voice modulator. We forgot to mention that. And I have a surprise for you.
What?
Okay, hang on. I gotta grab something.
Chesterfield Huxley, if you come back into this room with a voice modulator in your hand, I will die on the spot.
Surprise, Clementine.
Oh my God, I'm dead. Rest in peace, Clementine McDougal.
Don't worry, I'll throw you an awesome funeral.
Where did you get that?
A good podcaster never reveals his sources, but eBay.
I can't. You made my life with that.
Billy and Stu had one of these bad boys and used it every time they spoke to their victims over the phone.
It's actually a pretty genius way to disguise yourself and to essentially combine the work of two people into one entity with one voice.
Absolutely. So in Stu's foyer, and hearing that voice through the modulator, Sydney realizes that it's been her boyfriend and one of her close friends terrorizing her and the town. They move into the kitchen, where Billy and Stu reveal their motives. Billy's primary motivation being what Sydney's mother did to his family, as we discussed.
So, if that's the case, why kill Casey and Steve and Himbry?
Well, there's two possibilities. Casey and Stu used to date, as we mentioned, but word is that Casey dumped Stu for Steve. Casey also sat next to Sydney in English, so it certainly makes sense that looping Casey and Steve into the plan would be twofold effective. Personal revenge for Stu and an easy way to rattle Sydney. We also know from Sydney's official statement that the guys often discuss the idea of movies and life being like a movie. Stu referenced watching horror movies and taking notes in order to successfully execute their master plan. So maybe the lines between the movies and reality just became too blurry for these guys, especially Stu, who, let's face it, is not the sharpest tool in the shed.
Yeah, they certainly did their homework. They combined corn syrup and red dye to create fake blood, a trick utilized by the filmmakers behind Stephen King's Carrie. Billy was known to discuss and even quote Norman Bates and Hannibal Lecter, the villains from the film Psycho and The Silence of the Lambs, respectively. Sydney's report also stated that Billy and Stu enjoyed toying with her, both on the phone leading up to the mocker party and at the party itself, after they revealed themselves to her. They spoke to her in casual, playful ways, and at the drop of the hat would turn aggressive and vulgar, almost embodying the qualities of Lecter or any other movie villain.
Back in the kitchen, Stu drags Sydney's father, who was tied up and gagged, out of the hall closet, and it becomes clear to Sydney how their master plan will end. Billy and Stu slide the voice modulator and cell phone into Neil Prescott's pockets, then begin stabbing each other in the arm and the side in an attempt to make Neil look like the killer and them look like innocent victims. But it all doesn't go exactly as they planned.
No, it doesn't. Amidst the chaos, Sydney manages to escape the kitchen, bringing her dad with her. Using the cell phone and modulator, she calls Stu's house, toying with the guys on the phone as they toyed with her. Karma's a bitch, boys.
Sydney eventually reveals herself, stabbing Billy near his collarbone with the pointy end of an umbrella she found while hiding in the closet. Stu comes running in, and the two physically struggle in the living room. Police found the couch cushions ripped apart and various pieces of furniture tipped over. With Sydney gaining the upper hand and pushing the insanely large TV off of the shelf and right onto Stu's head.
Billy, who is still alive, musters up his strength to have one last physical fight with Sydney as she re-enters the foyer. But who suddenly appears to save the day?
Gale fucking Weathers!
Gale Weathers indeed, that shady, beautiful bitch. Gale pops up in the doorway to the house with a gun, and after some initial struggling to get the gun to fire, she manages to shoot Billy in the chest, sending him to the floor. What did Papa Oscar think when the news broke that Gale swooped in and saved Sydney?
Oh my god, you know Oscar loved that.
But the shot from Gale still didn't take Billy down for good. So Sydney grabs the gun from Gale and fires off one final shot right in the middle of his forehead, effectively ending this horrific murder spree and returning Woodsboro to normalcy. Well, as normal as you can get after something like that. All told, Billy and Stu took the lives of 5 people, including Maureen Prescott. Sydney, Gale, Randy, and Dewey all survived the attacks at the Mocker House and did their best to move forward and rebuild their lives. And that, my friends, is the Woodsboro Murders.
Shit, we did it. Our first episode in the bag.
Clem, my dear, we killed it. Pun intended.
Thank you so much to everyone for listening to our first episode of Murder Tonic. I'm Clementine McDougal.
And I'm Chesterfield Huxley. May your men be hot,
your cocktails be cold,
and your true crime obsession never die. Thanks, everyone. See you next time.